Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. With John Boehner, the Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, having announced his resignation at the end of this month, and Kevin McCarthy, the leader of the Republican majority in the House, choosing not to be a candidate for Speaker in the election currently set for October 29th, the House of Representatives is reportedly in chaos. In this edition of Radio Curious, we visit with Congressman Sam Farr, a longtime friend who has represented Monterey and Santa Cruz counties on the central coast of California since 1993. We discuss the presence of the Freedom Caucus in the House of Representatives and the current consequences of that caucus's efforts to unseat Speaker Boehner. Congressman Farr also explains his views on other current political issues. Sam Farr and I visited by phone from his home in Washington, D.C. on October 9th, 2015, and began our conversation when I asked him to provide a context to the current fray in the House of Representatives.
Well, the Speaker of the House of Representatives is the chief operating officer of the politics, and that Speaker is elected by the majority. In this case, a majority of members of Congress is 218 votes. And it does indicate that the Speaker has to have that 218. The difficulty the Republicans have had is that when Boehner indicated that he wanted to resign, that he'd been fed up. First of all, he was triggered by a motion filed on the floor to have what they call vacate the chair. And that means that if it gets a majority of the votes to sort of kick out the Speaker, the chair is vacated and you have to elect a new one. So they filed that motion.
Who is the they?
The Republicans, who are part of a group called the Freedom Caucus. They're a new group of Tea Partiers and right-wingers.
And how many are members of that group?
Well, it's on the other side of the aisle, and we're not privileged to be in those meetings, but the rumors in the paper talks about 30 members. I'm sure that some of them break away from time to time, but they've stayed together pretty solid as a block. Many of them voted against Boehner, which was a brave move because they were newly elected to Congress, and it's the only time in our proceedings where actually every member is called by name in alphabetical order, and then has to vote for anybody they want to. But, you know, the Democrats nominate Nancy Pelosi and the Republicans nominated John Boehner, but not every Republican voted for him.
So 30 or so members of Congress seem to have a significant authority among the 435 total members, particularly in effectively deposing the sitting Speaker of the House.
Yeah, it's really a numbers game, but the party sticks together, so you don't look at it as 435. You look at how many, because if the Democrats had enough votes to be put their person in as Speaker, they definitely would. We have 177 Democrats now, and the Republicans, 247. They need 218, so they have a leeway of quite a few of, you know, they can lose those votes and still have the majority. But with the Freedom Caucus, who are Tea Party members, of pulling out saying they're not going to support the mainstream Republicans, and not that the mainstream means they're at all mainstream. They're more, in my opinion, they're all very, very much to the right, more so than I've ever seen it in Congress.
Up until October 7th or 8th, Kevin McCarthy, a member of Congress from the Central Valley of California, was the presumed heir apparent to be Speaker because he's next in line. But then he dropped out, which has created the term chaos. What's your insight, your thoughts on why Kevin McCarthy chose not to run for Speaker?
Well, I think both the incidents of John Boehner announcing that he was going to step down, and Kevin McCarthy then later on, as of yesterday, saying he was going to step down, it was in both cases total shock. Nobody knew it was coming. They hadn't discussed it with anybody. It's all for different reasons. John Boehner, as I said, was facing a vote on the floor, essentially, I guess you'd call it in another parliamentary forum, as a no-confidence vote. And many thought that he would lose that. And so, and I think with him arranging to have the Pope visit the Capitol and make an address before Congress, which is an interesting little issue because only heads of state are allowed to address Congress, whereas the Dalai Lama met with members of Congress in Statuary Hall. He was not allowed to address a joint session of Congress because he is not recognized as head of state. We have diplomatic relationships with the Holy See, and we have an ambassador to the Holy See. So the Pope was qualified as almost as any head of state would be to come and do a joint session. And Boehner arranged for that, and he's a Catholic, and he was very, very moved by it. And I think that at least some of the sayings are that Boehner felt, look, this is a complicated caucus to try to stay in charge of. They don't give me the authority to make deals with the Democrats and pass anything. They just want to shut down the House every time they get a chance to. It's too high risk. It's not worth it. And I couldn't accomplish much more than getting the Pope here. And I think he woke up the next morning and said, you know, why put up with it anymore? So Kevin McCarthy was the next in line, and Kevin was the heir apparent. He was trying to put together the votes, and he had the same problem Boehner had, was that this caucus of right-wingers indicated they would not support him. And he tried over and over again. Then the other rumor is, and you know, I hate these rumors that he had some another member of Congress been romantically involved. I don't know whether that's true or not. It's certainly out there on the internet, and members of Congress have passing up, and he hasn't said anything about it, nor she. But that's a lot of speculation of why the immediacy that he couldn't be vetted by his own members. There was a letter circulating by Walter Jones, who's been a really interesting member who's been the leading person against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And Walter circulated a letter just saying that if anybody's going to run for Speaker of the House, I hope they will be vetted. They'll vet themselves privately, because if they have any indiscretions in their background that we don't know about, they should immediately decline the offer. And right after that letter came out, Kevin declined the offer. So there's some speculation there. Well, they don't have anybody heir apparent now. They're just scrambling, like, well, who will do it? And Paul Ryan, who was, you know, the Republican nominee for vice president, has been pressured now. He's head of the Ways and Means Committee. I think he wants to be president of the United States someday. And he knows, and everybody else knows, that if he accepts the speakership job, that's the last political title he'll have, because that job just ruins you for any other public office.
Why does it ruin the speaker?
Well, you just have to make a lot of tough decisions and, as you know, compromises. And it's one thing to have members feel passionately about something. It's a different thing to try to put together the 218 votes to get the job done. You know, you have 435 egomaniacs back here who all are very adamant about how they feel about anything, and some of those feelings are not willing to compromise at all. So you have a difficult time, and you pay a penalty for it, and you create a lot of enemies. So,
Sam Farr, let's stay, if we can, with the Freedom Caucus and focus on your comment that they want to shut down the government. What's behind that from your perspective?
Well, Barry, what really struck me, and I've been on your radio program many times, and what's different from the times in the past is you have a Congress that is very young in experience. You have 50% of the members of Congress been elected in the last 4 years, and from 2012 and 2014. That's a lot. That's a majority of people who essentially don't know about how the institution works. They come here very opinionated. Many come with a conservative viewpoint, is that not only government is wrong, and we want to drown it, kill it, stab it, we want to make it not functional, But Congress itself is wrong, and they don't, you know, they're the people that block the votes to even give our own staff a well-deserved cost-of-living adjustment that hasn't been adjusted for years. Some of these people decide that they don't want to get what they call Washingtonized, whatever that means, and say they're going to sleep in their offices because they really don't want to meet anybody or deal with anybody in the social life of Washington. So it's a really strange attitude. I mean, why do you apply for the job if you don't like what the job is supposed to do and the environment in which it is? But nonetheless, they're here, and they've bonded together, and they've been very effective in that bond by just throwing a monkey wrench into anything. Remember, we have a lot of deadlines for things, just like we have for taxes and for renewing driver's licenses and things like that the individual has to pay attention to, and they block the ability to get that done and drive it right to the brink of, you know, falling over the cliff. They've just allowed one thing that really bugged me came out today. I mean, they have blocked the Land and Water Conservation Fund from being reauthorized. It sunsetted, and they won't allow. This is money that the federal government receives from oil companies drilling for oil in publicly owned lands off the coasts of our country, and it goes into a fund to essentially help states and local governments buy parks and upgrade open space. The idea that they're taking a resource that belongs to the public and depleting it, that being oil, and therefore, with that depletion, pay into a fund which will allow us to renew or acquire land that will be sustainable, renewable. And that's been paying for so many of the acquisitions of parklands all over the United States for years and years, and now that fund has just been wiped out. The money will be collected, it'll just go into the Treasury.
Sam, you said that they refused to renew it. Who is the they?
Well, the Republican leadership here in Congress and the House. It's sunsetted, so what you have to do is take affirmative action. You have to pass a bill to reauthorize it.
Which requires the Speaker to release it to committee and the committee chair to mark it up for a hearing.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, Sam, before we move on to other issues about Congress and what's happening, what is your take on how the process of choosing the next Speaker of the House of Representatives will evolve?
Well, we're not in the game. I mean, the Democrats are the minority party. I would think be very clever right now with what's going on. Take a moderate Republican. You'd have to have about 31 votes, but find a moderate Republican who could walk across the aisle and say to Nancy Pelosi, if you get me your 177 Democrats, I can be Speaker. And obviously, if we gave the majority of the votes, they'd pay a lot of attention to getting things done. But I don't think anybody in the Republican Party has the guts to do that. We saw that happen in California back in the 1980, when we had the huge speakership fight that divided the Democratic Party in California right down the middle. And meanwhile, Willie Brown goes over to Republicans and says, if you'll give me all your votes, I'll make you all vice chairs of the committees that I appoint you to, and I'll give you a good budget. And Carol Hallett said, that's a deal. And Willie went back to the caucus, and he had enough other Democratic votes, along with the Republicans, to elect him Speaker. So California certainly has shown that there's different ways of putting together the votes necessary to become Speaker. Nobody in Congress has thought about that yet or willing to try it.
Why is that? Presumably, if you're elected to Congress, you have some shrewdness as a politician. You have a front row seat.
The Republican in this case would have to find 31, I think, other Republicans. You know, that would be very hard to get that many people willing to abandon their party. That's what they'd be doing in order to get the Democratic votes.
Well, let me say this. In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Congressman Sam Farr, who represents Santa Cruz and Monterey counties on the central coast of California in his 23rd year as a member of Congress. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Sam, you mentioned the Republican congressman who is very much against the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. What is your position on funding that war?
I'm opposed to all. The problem in Congress is we've never had a chance to vote for peace until the Iranian agreement came forward. And I said very strongly that the reason I was so much enthusiastically in support of it is because this was the first time we ever had got to vote for a peace agreement rather than just voting against going to war. And Walter Jones has been one of those Republicans who's been so outspoken. I mean, he's told me, and in fact, he said it today, he said, I felt so guilty. So I really complimented him about writing a letter to a family whose father was killed in Iraq. He was an older officer in the military, and when I went to his service, I was going to speak. They read a letter from Walter Jones. Now, Walter Jones is from South Carolina, and, you know, he really had no interest in families in my district, but he has written every single family of a soldier killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he told me that's his penance for having voted for the war, because he's very much opposed to it now.
So where do you see future funding on the agenda in the House and the Senate?
Well, we're not really in anywhere. We're calling our troops back from Afghanistan. There's still going to be a lot of debate. The John McCain's of the world want us to fully withdraw. I would like to increase troops there. I think he also has been advocating wherever there is conflict, we ought to just be sending more and more troops. It's not what the American people want. The Pentagon budget is a humongous budget here. And, you know, I think I've told your listeners before that, and it's really worth repeating, the four big items of the federal budget, 73% of the entire federal budget, go to four categories. Goes to defense, health care, Medicare, and things like that. Interest on the debt, the amount of money we borrow and pay interest on. It's shockingly how much money we've paid and how much interest we have to pay. And the fourth one is Social Security. Of course, Social Security pays for itself because it's in a trust fund. And if you think about it, Defense Department is only the discretionary one. So as I said, Social Security is paid for. It has a trust fund. We're going to pay our interest on our debt if we want to maintain our global respect from people buying our treasury bonds. And we're going to pay for health care costs. So the ones that you have some discretion on, say, how much we should cut, is really a Defense Department, but you've got an awful lot of lobbyists in Washington who are there to defend every little defense item, and a huge personnel block called veterans and soldiers who essentially want payment for their services. We're kind of stuck.
Well, Congressman Sam Farr, help me understand why Bernie Sanders is not addressing the military budget.
Well, I don't know. You probably have to ask Bernie Sanders. It's very difficult to get support when you have ISIS and other kinds of things that the American public is scared to death of, and you don't have a lot of popularity in just going out and cutting the defense budget. And the big defense budget is difficult to define. What we really ought to be doing is going after and supporting what the Pentagon wants, is to cut out a lot of this unnecessary equipment that we're buying, or equipment that they're trying to phase out. But members of Congress are supporting the labor force and the unions and others who are in the district manufacturing those trucks and tires and tanks and airplanes the Pentagon says we don't need anymore. This is not part of a modern warfare arsenal. And I think, Barry, the most important one we ought to look at, and nobody's talking about, is that we're about to spend trillions of dollars in refurbishing our nuclear arsenal in the United States and where we have it placed in other countries around the world. I think this is a foolish investment. We ought to be dismantling these things in the modern world, not just going out and spending, as I said, trillions of dollars over time. And we got enough arsenal to blow this planet to smithereens. And that's just us.
You mentioned the Pentagon's defense budget spending ideas, and you talked about trucks and related aspects of trucks. And the response is that's no longer necessary in the kind of war we have, but the representatives from Congress support it because of employment for their district. Enough representatives of Congress support the budget because It helps them.
Well, Barry, here's what happens is the Pentagon puts together its budget, its asks. They give it to the White House. The White House scrubs it through the Office of Planning and OMB, Office of Management and Budget. They scrub every one of the functions of federal government. They're the chief cook and bottle washer when it comes to working for the president. The president brings his budget to the Congress. We put it into 13 different bills, and including a defense bill and an interior bill and so on, and go through every item in what we call the Appropriations Committee. And I'm on, and there's 13 subcommittees, and I'm ranking member on the Ag Appropriation, Ag and FDA Appropriations Committee. So we spend 6 months of the year going through that budget, and then we put it all together and give it back. What's happened with the defense budget is when Congress puts it back, it doesn't reflect what the Pentagon asked for. It's got a lot of add-ons. They may have cut some stuff, too, that the Pentagon wanted, but it's got a lot of add-ons. And so, you know, the president's even said, if you send me back that budget, it's so different than the one I sent you, the one I asked for, I'll veto it if it comes to my desk. And, you know, people, it hasn't happened yet because we haven't been able to send him that budget because we haven't done our work. We're just operating on a continuing resolution. We're not, hopefully maybe by December we'll get it done. But the point of this is that it's easy for a lot of people to then vote against the defense appropriations bill because it has so much stuff in there that the Pentagon doesn't want.
So the budget can continue indefinitely with the continuing resolution to support it?
The CR is based on the expenditures of the previous year, and we've been running government on that for several years. So we're spending level at about 2007 level. I mean, think about it. If assuming your income has increased a little bit with the cost of living adjustments and that you're earning a little bit more than you were in 2007, not the federal government. We have to pay, regardless of the fact that the bills have gone up, just like the bills in your house have gone up for garbage and water and things like that, and you don't have additional money if you're spending at 2007 levels. So what you have to do is cut out people in order to pay the operational costs. And that's what the federal government's been doing. It's been actually downsizing. Far fewer federal employees now than there were a couple of years ago. Programs are hurting.
And that puts former federal employees in a state of economic distress, are being deprived of what they might have otherwise had, including their job.
What you do is you cut the program for newcomers or for people that need aid, you just have less aid. It really does hurt probably more than the elderly, although we may cut back on how much money we appropriate for buying prescription drugs and things like that. So it could have some cost implications for elderly. But by and large, it's the newcomers. It's the younger, the new babies trying to get access to health care or early childhood education, things like that.
Well, Sam Farr, I want to thank you for being with us once again on Radio Curious and the usual questions that I know we may have discussed in the past, but I'd be interested in hearing your 2015 take on it, is about an aha or eureka moment in your life that changed your view of the world or gave you a new path to follow.
I always think that probably the most incredible feeling I got right after my sister was killed visiting me in the Peace Corps from a horseback riding accident. She died on the operating table when I went home for her funeral. And she died right after my mother had died of cancer. So I was flying back to Peace Corps sort of really too super depressed, you know, and giving up my hope and everything. Why live? Why? No faith in anything. And kind of angry with the Third World. You know, if she had access to health care like would in a developed country, maybe she would have lived. So the question myself was sort of in my anger was, why the hell am I going back to Peace Corps to help these people, you know? And then it was what really hit me, and it was on the airplane, was, oh, my God, why did you join the Peace Corps in the first place? And didn't you think that these things would happen, that people would die from, lack of access and things like that? And the answer was, yes, I did, but I never thought it would be my own family. And realized that no matter what you add, the passport to get out of the country, the money to pay for services, all those things that people in poverty don't have, it didn't make any difference. When you're facing a crisis and you're living in a place with nothing, there's no way to respond. So what that moment turned into was this incredible sorrow, but the idea, I don't want any person in the world to have to suffer the pain that I'm suffering from losing my sister. I'm going to dedicate my life to wiping out the root causes of poverty, not only around the world, but mainly at home. And that's what really got me back into law school and to working in the legislature and finally running for office. And my goal all my life has been to work on the root causes of the culture of poverty, and that is giving people, you can get out of poverty if you have access to education. Got to have access, which is physical, got to be nearby, and it's got to be affordable. Same thing with health care. You've got to have it. You've got access to it. It's got to be nearby, and it's got to be affordable. And the third is you have to have a safe place to sleep. Maybe you have to start with a safe place. And obviously you have to have food. If you have access to those three things, you have a chance. And so that was my incredible aha moment. I mean, it just changed my life and gave me perspective of what I wanted to do for the rest of my life.
Well, that's the next question. What do you want to do for the rest of your life?
When I grow up, what do I want to do with my life? Well, I'll be 75 next year. I don't know. I'm still in Congress and we may have to make that decision before we file sometime next year. I think you're a great teacher and a great mentor to people, and particularly this kind of radio program of getting information out in this world where we get an awful lot of false information. And I think teaching is really important, and able to enjoy friendships. I mean, we all work really hard, and even our friendship has been very strong because of our mutual experience in the Peace Corps at the same time, but we have very little time to ever spend to see each other. You're busy, I'm busy, and schedules never allow it. I think retirement allows you to reconnect with your friends and family, and that's also a wonderful elderly option.
And a final question, Sam Farr. Can you recommend a book to our listeners?
David McCullough's book is on the Wright brothers, and it's fascinating because we just think about these guys, flying the first aircraft, but they were just geniuses and sort of the Steve Jobs of their era, and they were just so fascinated by the flight and what they did to get to Kitty Hawk, and what they've done, what they did with their lives afterwards is really a good read.
Well, Congressman Sam Farr, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Well, thank you very much, Barry. You're delightful to put this program on. I really appreciate it.
Congressman Sam Farr has represented Monterey and Santa Cruz counties on the central coast of California in the United States House of Representatives since 1993. The book he recommends is The Wright Brothers by David McCullough. This program was recorded on October 9th, 2015. Radio Curious has over 500 archive editions on our website, radiocurious.org, with new programs published weekly. You may stream, download, subscribe to our podcast service, and share them as you wish. They're all free. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onnestad is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.